The following program is intended for blind and print-impaired listeners and is a production of the North Carolina Reading Service. And that program is the Indie Week. John Federson at the state-of-the-art audio controls today, bringing you this issue, which is dated, actually the broadcast is dated of July the 21st of 2023. And we'll get started with the issue. A reminder that we're getting most of our stories now offline from the IndieWeek.com website. Their print issue is irregular, to say the least, and the stories are a little more updated and also are from other outside sources than the typical Indie Week of just a year or so ago. And our first story will be by Hannah Kaufman, which talks about Legal Aid NC. They're expanding the Housing Justice Services in Raleigh and Eastern North Carolina. A variety of factors are responsible for housing instability in low-income communities. In the Tar Heel State, the two most common causes are air, property, and eviction, air being H-E-I-R. According to Legal Aid North Carolina, a nonprofit that provides legal advice to North Carolina residents to help them avoid displacement and homelessness. Predominantly seen in black and rural communities in the state, air property refers to arrangements whereby homes and land are passed down outside of the courts, often through families and over several generations. Issues arise when family members die without leaving a will. Then there's eviction, which affects low-income communities everywhere. But with a $450,000 grant from the Wells Fargo Foundation, Legal Aid NC plans to target both these causes and expand housing justice services for homeowners and renters in this region. The statewide law firm provides free legal help in civil matters to low-income people who are often battling legal problems that affect basic human needs, including caring for family, finding housing, continuing education, finding employment, and receiving income. The two-year grant will be divided into two segments. $300,000 of the funds will go toward launching Legal Aid's Air Property Pro Bono Project, an effort to involve that law firm in air property work within the region. The Pro Bono Project will partner with the North Carolina Bar Association's Real Property Section to recruit North Carolina real estate lawyers and paralegals that can help air property owners formalize their home ownership and resolve complex issues that arise from not having clear titles to their home and land. Lawyers will help property owners establish clear title to their home and land in order to preserve generational wealth in families and affordable housing in low-income communities. Susie Kuntz, a philanthropy and community impact specialist at Wells Fargo, said overall, the grant is aimed to provide opportunities for more people to create generational wealth through home ownership. We are proud to provide this important grant to Legal Aid NC to help more families in Raleigh and across eastern North Carolina access the legal services they need to stay in their homes and address systems that often lead to loss of property, land, and wealth for families of color. The remaining $150,000 will go towards work to expand eviction defense in Raleigh, as well as Edgecombe and Nash counties. Pamela Thoms, managing attorney of the nonprofit's Raleigh office, said keeping families in their homes by preventing eviction has always been one of our top priorities at Legal Aid, NC. But there are never enough resources to help everyone who needs us. This funding will allow us to provide life-changing legal help to families who would otherwise have nowhere else to turn. On to the next shorter story, this one by Wiley Cash, Dateline 714, July 14th. Storms and stories. Storms have been on my mind a lot lately. Perhaps this is because we are in the early days of hurricane season here on the southeastern coast of North Carolina, where our late afternoons and evenings are routinely interrupted by downpours and cracks of thunder. As a matter of fact, as I write these very words, an afternoon storm has settled over Wilmington. Thunder rattles the window panes on my home. Fat raindrops clatter like buckshot on the roof. Or perhaps I've been thinking about storms because of the many fictional portrayals of them. Jesmyn Ward brilliantly covered the plight of the have-nots in her 2011 National Book Award-winning novel, Salvage the Bones, in which a young black girl is struggling to survive even before a storm based on Hurricane Katrina ravages coastal Mississippi. Novelist Michael Ferris Smith used the terror created by Katrina as inspiration for his 2013 novel, Rivers, in which the American South, from the Florida Panhandle to western Louisiana, has been utterly devastated by a series of seismic hurricanes. Not quite done with the carnage, Smith published Salvage This World this April, a novel that explores the horrors that might await a region that has been brought to its knees by climate change. And last year, Bruce Holzinger published a novel titled The Displacements, in which a superstorm hits South Florida, leveling the playing field between the haves and have-nots in a post-apocalyptic New South. We have our own legacy of hurricanes here in North Carolina, none more recent or more memorable than 2018 Hurricane Florence. And writers are slowly building a literary legacy by which that storm will be remembered. Poet Emily Page Wilson's recently published novel in verse, 4 months Past Florence, is one of the early literary portrayals of that storm that caused 52 deaths and $24 billion of damage. The idea of writing a novel in verse, which is to say a novel comprising poems, came about in 2016 after a literary agent who had read some of her poetry online contacted Wilson. The agent asked Wilson if she had ever considered writing for a young adult audience, and if so, would she consider writing a novel in verse? Wilson had just graduated with an MFA in poetry from UNC Wilmington and was balancing a professional life that found her teaching at two separate community colleges in southeastern North Carolina while working a retail job in Wilmington. She jumped at the opportunity to write a novel under the eye of a literary agent, but neither Wilson nor her agent were happy with the early results. Wilson told me recently, "I finished it and I learned a lot. I submitted it to my agent and she said, 'This isn't it,' and I knew it. But it was like a golden carrot in front of me. I was fresh out of grad school. I didn't have a network or connections. So to have a literary fairy godmother saying, 'I believe in you,' was a guiding light. I knew I needed to start working on a second project." And then Florence hit. Wilson and her partner evacuated to Pitt County from their home in downtown Wilmington near the banks of the Cape Fear River. As they took down the plywood from their windows nearly 2 weeks later, the entire plot of what would become Wilson's first published novel formed in her mind. 4 months past Florence is narrated by Millie Willard, a high school junior with big journalism dreams who serves as a weather reporter for her school's student newspaper. Florence offers Millie experiences she never could have imagined. Wilson eloquently employs the hurricanes as a metaphor to track the storms of friendship, family, education, and social pressures. While working on the novel, and even after finishing it, Wilson kept thinking about how her experience of Florence would have been different had she been forced to stay in Wilmington. She says, "If we hadn't had people to take us in for 11 days, we would have been wiped out. Sometimes people don't evacuate because of lack of resources. What about the people who can't leave?" Now, the author of this article, Wiley Cash, says, "I'm currently writing a hurricane novel of my own, and like Wilson, I'm thinking about people who don't have the resources to evacuate. I'm also thinking about people who can't fully recover, regardless of whether or not they flee, people like Mary McCoy, a 90-year-old resident of a historically black area of Brunswick County called Piney Grove." McCoy told Wilmington Star News that she almost didn't return after Florence, during which floodwaters rose past her windows and swept away part of her house foundations. Most of her neighbors decided not to come home. She said, "Every room in my house was completely gutted. I'm just going to find me somewhere else to go. It doesn't matter where, as long as it's uphill." Sometimes insurance or federal programs are of little assistance, especially in rural, historically black communities where homes have been passed down through what is known as heirs' property, making it difficult to track down deeds and titles after a catastrophe. The circular nature of the experiences we're having with major storms mystifies Wilson, too, who notes that these experiences teach us lessons that many of us, especially those who could change building codes or land use rules or cut regulatory red tape, refuse to learn. As she points out, there were people who hadn't yet recovered from the damage of Hurricane Matthew when Florence hit. Wilson says, "Citizens on the individual level are wondering what power or agency or choice they have in helping to combat these storms caused by global warming. I think hurricanes make us confront our own limitations." Season after season of record-breaking storms, rising waters, catastrophic winds, and lost lives. It almost sounds like fiction. Next, as we know, Indie Week is reaching out to sister and other publications for resources to add to its own pages, and this was originally published at Carolina Public Press by Mayor Scher about the new voter ID rule in North Carolina. Shalaya Brown, 20, is a registered North Carolina voter and works at a mall in Raleigh. Brown said she knew there was talk about a voter ID requirement. She had no idea it would be enforced in the upcoming local elections. Quote, "If I had such a hard time getting a state-issued ID as a black, lower-middle-income person, then somebody who's less fortunate than me is going to have an even harder time getting it, and that shouldn't mean they aren't able to vote," she said. While she does not have a valid driver's license, she does have a state-issued non-driver ID that was difficult to get. She had lost her Social Security card, which made it challenging to get a state-issued ID. Quote, "I had to go through all these channels to make a new Social Security card, go to my doctors to get documents from them, get everything notarized, and took 2 trips to my local DMV. I couldn't get an ID until I had all of this." Brown said she could have easily found herself in a situation at the polls this year where she wouldn't have been able to vote if she didn't get a state ID. Quote, "People who have a form of ID are very lucky, especially if they didn't have to struggle to get it," she said. Starting in August, when early voting for municipal elections begins, North Carolina voters must show a valid photo ID at the polls to vote. Experts and voting rights organizations are concerned that this requirement could have a bigger impact on voters of color, possibly preventing them from voting. Jovita Lee, the program director of North Carolina Black Alliance, a Raleigh-based nonprofit group that works with state and local partners on policy issues, says this is absolutely an anti-black, anti-brown requirement to our voting process. Sources state that the new requirement is part of a larger trend of voter suppression efforts in North Carolina. These efforts are often aimed at making it more difficult for minority voters to vote, and they've been criticized by civil rights groups, according to experts and nonprofit voting organizations in the state. Kathleen Robles, the senior voting rights counsel and litigation manager at Forward Justice, a nonprofit based in Durham, says black and brown voters are less likely to possess any of the acceptable voting IDs. Approximately 7% of registered voters, or more than 480,000, lack an acceptable voter ID, according to the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, another Durham-based nonprofit that partners with communities of color in the South and provides them with legal representation. That group filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the state's 2018 voter ID law. The new voter ID requirement stems from the North Carolina Supreme Court's April reversal of its decision in Holmes v. Moore. The court had previously declared a photo ID requirement unconstitutional, citing a violation of equal protection guarantee in the Constitution. Under the new requirement, voters must present a valid approved photo ID to vote. People who don't have a valid photo ID would have to take additional steps to get one. Justice Anita Earls, who serves on the state Supreme Court, said Justice Morgan and I dissented from the court's decision to rehear the voter ID case, and I continue to believe the court correctly decided the case the first time around. The vote to write is a fundamental right, preservative of all other rights. If the right to vote is undermined, it renders illusory all other rights, even the most basic, she wrote, for the majority in that first 89-page ruling on the 2018 voter ID law. The new requirement, which is set to be enforced in August, has been criticized by voting rights advocates who say it will disproportionately disenfranchise black and Latino voters. They also argued the requirement is unnecessary as there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in North Carolina. While Republican leaders say voter ID requirements will help prevent voter fraud, there is lack of evidence to suggest that voter fraud is a widespread problem. Grassroots organizations are working quickly to get voters involved and help in getting a voter ID. They're also telling voters to contact their state and county elections board to request a free photo ID. The 2013 law resulted in lower voter turnout among black and brown communities in the 2016 primary election due to voter ID requirements. Later, a federal court ruled the requirement discriminatory and in violation of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The court found the law was intentionally designed to discriminate against minority voters, and there was no significant evidence of widespread voter fraud in North Carolina. Although North Carolina appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court chose not to hear the case. North Carolina's history of restrictions includes voter disenfranchisement measures like literary tests, poll taxes, and redistricting. The poll tax requirement ended in 1920 and the literacy tests banned in 1965, but for most of North Carolina's voting history, North Carolinians have not been required to present a photo ID to vote, except for a single election in 2016. The state passed two voter ID laws in 2013 and 2018. The second, passed in 2018, was also challenged in court and struck down in 2021 by the NC Supreme Court, which found the law was racially discriminatory and violated the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The 2018 photo ID law case in North Carolina was a significant victory for civil rights groups, but now the requirement has been brought back to be enforced, as North Carolina joins 35 other states that require photo IDs to vote. Recent studies suggest that people of color who want to vote may face more challenges because of the voter ID requirement. Black voters in particular are 1.4 times more likely than white voters to lack a qualifying ID, according to a study conducted by a professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He matched records from the North Carolina registration file with individual records from ID providers like the DMV, public and private university and college systems, community colleges, and state agencies. The voter ID requirement disproportionately affects minority groups compared with white voters, according to Robles. Obtaining a valid voter ID can be particularly difficult for voters of color who lack transportation, financial resources, or internet access, he said. These additional steps create barriers for voters who may not have the time or resources to obtain the necessary ID. Andrea Benjamin, a professor of political science and African American studies at the University of Oklahoma, who has researched the implications of the voter ID requirement in North Carolina, agrees. She said that while a no-fee voter ID can be helpful as an additional alternative, it still poses a barrier for voters of color. Benjamin said IDs are not a constitutional right, but voting is, and the Constitution does not say we have to go through all these hoops to vote. She said the voter ID requirement is similar to voting restrictions in the past, like literacy tests and poll taxes, that also prevented black and brown people from voting in North Carolina. During the 2016 primary election, a black female voter, Alberta Curry, a resident of Fayetteville, challenged the voter ID law in state court. Curry was represented by Justice Anita Earlswine when Earls was still a practicing attorney. Curry did not have an ID, and while she wanted to get one, she didn't have a birth certificate because she was born at home, according to Earls. Under the first voter ID law of 2013, Curry could have voted as an absentee without an ID, but she wanted to vote in person. Earls said at the polls she was supposed to be offered a form to fill out why she didn't have an ID, but instead she was just turned away and couldn't vote. If there isn't a will to make sure that everyone who's otherwise registered and a citizen meets all the qualifications for voting, that requirement can be a barrier, she said. Now, what qualifies as a voter ID? For many, a valid North Carolina driver's license will qualify. Voters who don't have a photo ID will be able to cast a provisional ballot, but within 10 days, they will have to provide proof of identification for their vote to be counted. But for those who lack a driver's license or proof of identification, they'll have to take additional steps to present other forms of approved ID to either vote in person or as an absentee through mail-in voting. Here are acceptable forms of photo IDs for voting in North Carolina, apart from the state driver's license. They include a no-fee state ID from the Division of Motor Vehicles, a North Carolina voter photo ID card issued by a county board of elections, a driver's license or state ID from another state for voters registered in North Carolina within 90 days of the election, a U.S. passport or passport card. a state-approved college or university student ID, a state-approved state or local government or charter school employee ID. These IDs must be either unexpired or expired for 1 year or less to be accepted, according to the State Board of Elections. To obtain a free state ID from the DMV, voters have to provide several documents to verify their age and identity. That Social Security card, or document proving they have a Social Security number, and a document proving residency, like a utility bill, school records, or a financial statement. The State Board of Elections said that voters can soon get a voter ID from County Board of Elections, but there's no clear information on the process to get one. With one more month until early voting begins for the municipal elections, it's uncertain how to obtain an ID from county boards. In the past two decades, North Carolina's population has seen a growing number of black and brown residents, resulting in a changing demographic of eligible voters. The population of individuals identifying as multiracial has more than doubled, growing by 161%, or over 250,000 people, according to a 2020 census report. The report shows the fastest growing group in the state was the population of some other race at 207%. This group is followed by multiracial population, 161, Asian, 65, Hispanic, 40, Islander, 33, and black, 4.3%. Approximately 60% of North Carolinians identified as white. There are sizable black populations in urban areas, but half the population is in eight largely rural counties, according to Carolina Demography's study of the state's black population. Bertie, Hertford, Northampton, Edgecombe, Halifax, Warren, and Vance. Six of those counties are majority black in population, showed the study. Nonpartisan academic experts argue this requirement is racially motivated, aimed at hindering voting access due to the changing demographics. Zaphon Wilson, chair of the Department of Public Administration at NC Central in Durham, says North Carolina is becoming more black and brown. If the majority folks have easy access to voting, the political dynamic will change, and it has changed before in Barack Obama's first election in 2008, when the state went from red to purple. He said this is a movement by the Republican Party to limit voter access in North Carolina and other states in the South. Quote, the voter ID requirement is racially motivated, intentionally motivated, and strategically motivated, said Danielle Brown, Deputy National Field Director of the Black Voters Matter Fund, a national voting rights and advocacy organization that's partnered with communities in more than 25 states. Jeff Loperfido, the Interim Chief Counsel for Voting Rights at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, agreed that the voter ID requirement is racially motivated. He stated that his organization proved this during the trial on the constitutionality of the 2018 ID law. He said it is a direct response to the increased political power of black and brown voters. This has been a historical pattern in North Carolina, where gains are made by black and brown voters, and then those who hold power respond to that. Conservative leaders supporting stricter voting laws argue the new requirement will reduce voter fraud, but experts assert that voter fraud is extremely rare and claim that these additional measures create barriers for minority participation in the electoral process. New Hanover County's Republican chairman, Nevin Carr III, said in an interview this month, out of all the activities where an ID required, why is it Democrats only take issue with having to show an ID to vote? Is it just a coincidence that Democrats always seem to benefit when election systems are less secure? Today, the Democrat Party looks for ways to undermine the integrity of our election system. In April, Tim Moore, the NC House Speaker, stated the objective is to make it easy to vote but hard to cheat. But studies show voter fraud is not widespread in North Carolina. Between 2000 and 2012, North Carolina had a total of 15 alleged voter fraud cases, as revealed by an analysis by News 21 at Arizona State University. Out of those 15 cases, 6 involved instances of double voting, 2 involved voting by individuals with felony convictions or former felons who lacked voter rights, 5 involved the use of fictitious addresses, 1 involved a non-citizen casting a vote, and 1 case lacked sufficient evidence to substantiate a claim of voter fraud. Benjamin said, "It's not like we are at 100% turnout during elections for voter fraud to be a widespread issue. We're probably sitting at 50% right now. Voter fraud is not actually a problem to be solved by right now, and that's why it seems like the voter requirement is simply a barrier." Others say the United States has a safe voting system, and voter suppression methods, like the requirement, limit the political power of black and brown people. Wilson said, "We have one of the safest voting systems in the world. There are forces fighting to maintain and expand control over the last 4 to 5 years, and the whole notion has been to suppress voting across the board. Some conservative leaders are using voter suppression methods under the guise of integrity," said Wilson. Many North Carolina voters aren't even aware that IDs will be required this year or how to get one, according to nonprofit and grassroots organizations. Anthony Williams, 67, a retired resident of Raleigh, said, "Is that for real? Do we actually need a voter ID to cast our ballots this year?" Williams has a valid driver's license, but like 8 other voters of color that the Carolina Public Press interviewed, he wasn't aware of the new requirement. "It's going to slow people down from getting to the polls and give them reasons not to vote. This makes it hard for people who can't afford an ID." Carolina Public Press contacted nonprofits to connect with voters lacking a driver's license under the new voter ID requirement, but many voters declined to be interviewed. "There are many education gaps around this new requirement, so even if voters have the proper form of identification, it doesn't mean they know voter IDs are required," said Lee, the program director at North Carolina Black Alliance. He said, "Many people were unaware of the fact that voter IDs will be required during the upcoming elections, and there were people who didn't even know that the rule was coming back into play." This month, the North Carolina Black Alliance ran a program in honor of Juneteenth and went across specific regions in the state to release voter ID resources. The Black Voters Matter Fund also put together and distributed more than 5,000 copies of a resource guide on the new requirement to the communities it serves. Brown said, "Everyday people do not know this is going into effect, and so we are now in rapid response mode to let folks know what they need to be able to vote. One of the reasons many voters are unaware of new voter ID requirement is the lack of outreach from state and local agencies to inform voters about the new rule before elections," according to Loperfido and Brown. "The State Board of Elections does not have the funding for advertising or significant voter outreach, but it's hopeful the state budget will include some funding for these efforts," said NCSBE spokesperson Patrick Gannon. Earlier this month, the board requested a $6.5 million from the legislature to fund the outreach effort and train poll workers. The funding is still being negotiated, but the Senate's budget offers no additional funding and will cut the board staff by 2 persons. "There's a new voting requirement, but a lack of funding to support it, and because of that, it falls on grassroots organizers to try to ensure their communities have the resources they need." Once again, Brown said, We are the ones on the ground doing the work of the state, and that is a problem. Voters and the election administration, like poll workers, all require time to adapt to the new rule, Lo Perfido said. The state's ID approval process has not been finalized yet. The county boards of elections don't have the equipment to issue voter IDs, and the election administration is not prepared yet either. This time frame before elections is not sufficient. It's putting a lot of stress on the system. And that concludes that article. In the IndyWeek.com are some resources. The State Board of Election gives 10 facts about the new ID requirement on the criteria for acceptable ones and how to get a no-fee ID from the DMV. Some of those I've already read to you. Well, that concludes this particular article. All right, our major story, cover story, so to speak, from IndyWeek this week, written 719 by Mark Farinella, The Living Legacy of Piedmont Blues. John Locklear, who goes by the handle Lakota John, is a young Robeson County-based singer-songwriter. Like other young musicians, he performs at clubs and festivals. Unlike most of his contemporaries, he's performed at Kennedy Center and Library of Congress, and he's shared the stage with internationally renowned talents like Joe Bonamassa and Taj Mahal. These are remarkable honors for a 26-year-old and proof of the purposeful way Lakota John approaches his trade. He's building a successful artistic career by digging deep into indigenous music traditions of the Piedmont. That's the region between the Appalachian Mountains and the coastal plains. And he's combining these folk traditions with modern influences. He's getting noticed not just because of his extraordinary skills as guitarist and writer, but because in his own original compositions and performances, you can clearly hear traces of southeastern regional music of earlier times. Lakota John told The Assembly, which, by the way, is the journal from which this article appears, I'm aware of the music of my elders. I build on that. It's great music. I want to bring it forward in my music. Some 120 miles north in Durham, John Shane is an accomplished singer-songwriter. A 55-year-old Duke graduate, he's the 2019 winner of the International Blues Challenge in the solo duo category, outplaying 260 competitors. Like Lakota John, Shane's music takes the past and projects it forward for contemporary audiences. He creatively combines ragtime, blues, and swing with the folk music of the Piedmont. Like so many other musicians, Shane and Lakota John note that a number of different styles, genres, and musicians have influenced their musical inclinations. But one thing they have in common is that the music that came out of Durham's tobacco warehouses in the 1920s and 30s is foundational to the music they create and perform today, and they are in good company. The story of Durham is a vastly influential center of American musical culture, and it's long been overlooked. Whether you listen to artists who play country, rock, blues, jazz, or folk, if you listen carefully, you'll hear the echoes of a small group of early 20th century black musicians from Durham and the surrounding region. Their names are rarely mentioned or even remembered, but these trailblazers are still shaping the music we listen to today. Shane said that music they played is in the root system of American music. In the early decades of the 20th century, Durham's tobacco and processing industry offered thousands of black sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and rural laborers a way out of the endless cycle of debt and poverty. Demand for tobacco products seemed insatiable, and the Bull City was a land of opportunity. On the southwest corner of Pettigrew and Blackwell Streets, an enormous plant owned by the American Tobacco Company, manufacturer of Lucky Strike and 35 other brands, was turning out 5 million cigarettes an hour by 1939. On West Main Street, between Cigarette and Fuller Streets, Liggett and Myers plant had installed machines that could each produce 1,200 cigarettes per minute for the Chesterfield, Picayune, and other brands. On Morris Street, between Morgan and Fernway, the massive Imperial Tobacco Factory, that's a joint venture of 18 British tobacco manufacturers, was sorting and processing the region's famous and cherished Bright Leaf tobacco for export overseas. Nearby, the annual tobacco auctions took place in gigantic warehouses. Each fall, both black and white farmers bought their crops to the Durham warehouses, where they were bundled, graded, and sold to the highest bidding manufacturer or tobacco broker. Warehouse workers then re-dried, pressed, and packed the tobacco into barrels, where it was stored until called upon by the successful bidder. To make it all work, the industry needed cheap labor. Black workers comprised the majority of the industry's workforce, but they were hired only for the dirtiest, lowest-paying, most physically demanding jobs, like stemming, cleaning, and processing the leaves by hand. Supervisory roles and positions as machine operators were reserved for whites. In the latter half of the 20th century, folklorists at universities in North Carolina interviewed community elders like Margaret Turner, who could still vividly recall life in Durham in the 20s and 30s. She was a widow raising children when she got a job with American Tobacco Company and worked there for 38 years. She told North Carolina Central for an Oral History, published in 1988, "What they hired us for was the dirty work, not work in the cigarette department, but in the leaf department, where everything was dirty." Still, Durham was a city where you could get a job with a salary. From Reconstruction through the industry's demise in the late 20th century, tobacco powered North Carolina's economy. By 1937, due largely to the federal tobacco excise tax levied on producers, manufacturers, and wholesales, North Carolina was the fourth largest contributor to the United States Treasury. As the industry faltered in more recent decades, many of its massive structures were repurposed as office buildings, apartments, restaurants, biomedical research, and event venues. But they remain outsized reminders of a bygone era. What has been mostly forgotten is that tobacco also made Durham a creative epicenter for an almost lost genre of music known in recent years as the Piedmont Blues, or sometimes the East Coast Blues. Durham was at the heart of this musical form from its birth in the 20s until its disappearance at the onset of World War II. Only Atlanta can stake a greater claim in the development of the genre. Rediscovered during the folk revival of the late 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Piedmont Blues had an enormous influence on many of the most widely recorded British and American musicians of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Like the tobacco factories and warehouses, this all but abandoned music was repurposed for a different clientele. Describing a musical genre by detailing attributes tends to lead to generalizations and oversimplifications. The margins of musical styles are overlapping, and musicians listen to and are influenced by other musicians and styles. Separating expressions into neat, mutually exclusive categories is a pursuit fraught with trouble. Even so, one might say the alternating bass notes, syncopated melodies, which accents notes between the beats, and most notably, the lively and bright ragtime flavor characterize the Piedmont Blues. It was typically played on guitar, distinguished by its complex finger-picking patterns. Guitarists were sometimes accompanied by harmonica, washboard, and occasionally fiddle or mandolin. It often sounded like ragtime on guitar instead of piano, and vital to its popularity, you could dance to it. Indeed, weekend house parties were a common venue for recreation and social interaction. Dance music was essential, but most homes didn't have a piano. So guitarists playing Piedmont blues along with other popular up-tempo styles were called upon for the job. While this music could be widely heard in black communities throughout the Piedmont region, it was at the time overlooked or dismissed as an art form. After all, it was just the crude regional folk music of a marginalized, poor, and largely illiterate Jim Crow-era population of African-American laborers, farmhands, and family workers. In the earliest days of mass communications in the segregated South, most whites were unaware of it, and professional and middle-class black folks listened to the higher-class jazz and dance bands. Reginald Michener, a former Liggett Myers employee and a sharecropper's son, told the folklorist, "They used to classify guitar music as strictly the devil's music, and church-going folks didn't have nothing to do with it." That could have had something to do with the lyrics. As one might expect from any kind of blues, common themes included unrequited love, infidelity, economic hardship, incarceration, oppression, failure, frustration, and rambling from one place to the next. But the Piedmont blues could also be tawdry and vulgar. The Piedmont guitarist had a seemingly endless supply of double entendres. No one was writing this music down. Its community was largely illiterate, and the performers couldn't read music. They learned by ear. Fortunately, samples were recorded. In the 1920s, very famously, the Library of Congress launched an effort to search out and record indigenous American folk music. The white folklorist John Lomax and his son Alan spent years conducting field recordings throughout the South with an emphasis on African-American folk music. The Piedmont blues is among the musical styles they recorded. A handful of other researchers also made non-commercial field recordings of black folk music in the Piedmont region in the 1920s and 30s, even into the mid-50s. But by then, most listeners had moved on, and the Piedmont blues had become a relic. Other samples were collected by commercial record companies. In the early days of the white-dominated recording industries, record companies issued recordings of black gospel, jazz, and blues on what they called race records, intended to appeal to African-American consumers. Still, many of the Piedmont's finest musicians and folk songs were never recorded. They could be heard on farms, at family picnics, at wood sawings, corn shuckings, street corners, in black-owned diners and barber shops, and most notably, at the seasonal carnivalesque tobacco auctions that helped make Durham a center of gravity for this music. In an era in which radio was not yet universal, and before jukeboxes became commonplace, live performance was the source. Thomas Burt, a part-time musician, told the folklorist, "All around Durham and back up here near Stagville, there was a guitar in near about every house you went in." Piedmont guitarists could always find an audience along Pettigrew Street and on Fayetteville Street in Hayti, Durham's then vibrant black commercial district. Burt, aside from earning gratuities as a guitarist, strung together a living, working at various odd jobs at a sawmill, brickyard, tobacco factory, and elsewhere, stated, "Of the old guitar pickers, the best one I heard play was Arch Hammond. Arch stayed down in Hayti, and I would go down there, and me and him would get together and play all round Hayti." Like Burt, few of those Piedmont guitarists were full-time professionals, and most held one or more menial jobs. The ones who earned their living as full-time musicians were disproportionately blind or disabled and consequently unable to get work on a farm or in a factory. Those familiar with the Piedmont blues may recognize some of the genre's most prominent names: Blind Willie McTell, Blind Blake, Blind Boy Fuller, and the Reverend Blind Gary Davis. Harmonica master Sonny Terry was also blind but somehow avoided the moniker. They could rely only on their music and had few other options. But even part-timers like Burt could make money performing on the street corners. The most talented of the street musicians would get invited to play at often raucous weekend house parties where dancing and gambling were encouraged and alcohol and food were for sale. According to George Washington University ethnomusicologist Kip Mornell, some of these parties were informal, non-professional bashes that provided not just entertainment, but an opportunity for the host to make a few extra bucks selling food and booze. These parties were frequently referred to as sullens. Music was essential, and guitar players could earn good money from tips. Piedmont blues was central to the repertoire of many of the region's guitarists, but it wasn't the only style they played. Many started out playing gospel. Most could play all sorts of pop tunes and even the Scottish reels popular in the countryside. They were ready for whatever their audience, white or black, wanted to hear and would tip them for. Other house parties were commercial operations run by bootleggers where the musicians would receive a flat fee, but by the 1940s, live musicians were being replaced by piccolos, the brand name for the original jukeboxes. Still, the most important venues in the Piedmont were the tobacco auctions in Winston-Salem and Durham. During the several weeks of the auctions, Durham seemed more like a county fair than an industrial city. To musicians, the auctions meant money, visibility, opportunity. Each fall, black and white sharecroppers and tenant farmers would transport their crop to the tobacco warehouses and collect payment, likely for the first time since the prior year's auction. The Piedmont musicians would converge there too and perform in the giant warehouses and on street corners for tips from the recently paid farmers. Richard Trice played at Durham auctions with some of the genre's most popular musicians. His brother, Willie Trice, Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry, Bull City Red, and Blind Boy Fuller. In the documentary Shine On, Richard Trice and the Bull City Blues, Trice says, "See, them people were neighbors, them farmers. They'd sit in the back. And they, some of them, would get charged up, man. They were loose with the money, you know. They wanted to hear something." According to a study Lornell conducted, about 30% of the Piedmont region's blues musicians who recorded that style between 1924 and 1941 were in the Durham area. Among them was a blind guitarist, originally from Wadesboro, who became the most popular, commercially successful, and prolific figure in the genre, and most of the most popular and influential guitarists of the era, Blind Boy Fuller. His real name, Fulton Allen. He became blind in 1928, around the age of 21. He'd worked as a laborer, but then had to rely on playing guitar for tips outside factories. J.B. Long was the white manager of a candy and hosiery department at Durham's United Dollar Store on Main Street. He was also an American Record Corporation talent scout, and in 1935, he discovered Allen and soon rebranded him as Blind Boy Fuller. In an interview with Lornell for an edition of Living Blues magazine, Long recalled the first time he came upon Allen. "As I went around the warehouses trying to see some of the farmers, get them to come up the store and trade, you know, and I saw this blind fella, colored boy, man, he had on a blanket-lined overall jumper. I told him, 'I'm down here at the United Dollar Store department store. Come by and see me. I want to talk to you. You got a pretty good voice, and I'd like to talk to you about going and making records if you can do it.'" Fulton Allen accepted the invitation, and by the time of his death in 1941, at age 37, he had recorded a stunning 130 sides. The 78 RPM record could hold 3 to 5 minutes of music per side. For American Recording and Decca, one of the most important blues men of the 20th century, Fuller is buried in Grove Hill Cemetery on Durham's Fayetteville Street, but the precise location of his grave is not known. The dormant cemetery is now the site of Fayetteville Street Elementary and a small office building. Although Fuller was the most popular Piedmont musician of the era, it was another long discovery, the Reverend Blind Gary Davis, who is widely regarded as among the most skilled. By most accounts, Davis was Fuller's instructor and mentor, and his music is viewed as more creative and original. Bluesman Willie Trice said, "Davis never let a string be still. He was the playingest man I ever saw. He could make 500 chords while I was trying to play two." In July of 1935, Long drove Fuller and Davis, along with a Durham washboard player, who Long dubbed Bull City Red, to Manhattan for their first recording sessions, lasting 4 days. New York trip launched Fuller on a prolific recording career, but it was not a good experience for Davis, who felt that Long cheated him. Often cantankerous, stubborn, and suspicious, Davis didn't record again for a decade and a half. Sometime in the mid-30s, Davis was ordained as a Baptist minister, devoted himself to the church, and often insisted on playing only spirituals. He moved to the Bronx in 1944, where he scraped together a living largely by preaching and singing on street corners, that is, until the folk revival of the late 50s and 60s brought him new opportunities. He was convinced to return to the studio, where he recorded both secular and religious music, but regardless of which he played, the Piedmont style from his days in Durham could be clearly heard. Durham also launched the internationally successful 35-year partnership of guitarist Brownie McGee and harmonica virtuoso Sonny Terry. Originally from Greensboro, Terry began playing with Fuller at the Durham warehouses and street corners in the mid-30s and frequently recorded with him. A few months after Fuller's death, in February of 1941, McGee and Terry recorded together for the first time. But as interest in the Piedmont blues faded in the South, the pair moved to New York City in 1942, where there was still a vibrant blues scene in the massive black community that had migrated northward, and a budding interest in folk music among affluent, educated whites. Throughout the revival, the duo recorded, played folk clubs and festivals, made TV appearances, and ultimately performed in nightclubs and concert halls around the world as a headline act. By the end of their careers, they had become the most famous and celebrated exponents of the Piedmont style. Well, I've had to curtail by about three paragraphs the end of this wonderful article on Piedmont blues, and here's another musical form that's coming to an end in 40 seconds. John Federson has time to tell you that this is podcast available on ncreadingservice.org from the Indie Week, and we'll be back next week with a further edition. You can find further articles if you go to indieweek.com. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, we bid you farewell.